The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Westcott was pretty well ignored by everybody except evangelicals. So he doesn't really figure much in the story that followed after him. Okay, and then the second little blip on the screen is Austin Farrar. Austin Farrar wrote an article on dispensing with Q, where Farrar argued that Mark was the first gospel indeed, but Q, that is this Quellosaurus, was not necessary at all. It's simply the case that Matthew used Mark and that Luke used both Matthew and Mark. And so he simplified it and said, we don't need this Quellosaurus, which is purely hypothetical anyway, just that Matthew used Mark and then Luke used both Mark and Matthew. He used Mark and then supplemented from Matthew. That view has been revitalized recently. I guess I'll come back to that when we get to the modern time. In 1924, the two-source theory got its final development in the form that we now have it, which is the dominant theory. And it was given this form by B.F. Streeter, 1924, and he simply argued two things. First of all, that you don't really need Urmark. Rather, what you can do is simply suppose that Matthew didn't use Urmark, but Mark itself. So he simplified that aspect. You just have Mark and Q. The second thing that he did, and that Matthew and Luke are using Mark and Q. The second thing that Streeter added was that Matthew also had a special Matthean source, which he designated M, and that Luke had a special source, which he designated L. There's a lot of material, for example, in Luke that, specifically it's easy to see because Luke himself writes in a very educated, polished, Hellenistic Greek style. He doesn't write in a particularly Jewish kind of style most of the time, particularly in Acts when he's recording the travels of Paul and stuff. But in certain places in Luke, Luke's language becomes very, very highly Semitized, very Hebrewish in character, or Aramaicish in character. And Streeter argued then that Luke is using some kind of Jewish source there and copying from it, and that explains the language. For example, in the infancy narratives, Luke's language is very Jewish there, Hebrewish, and Streeter argued that he's using a special source. So this now is called the four-source theory because there are four sources, M, Mark, Q, and L. And that is the dominant form of the Markan hypothesis that that is taught now in most university settings in the world. And in fact, that ruled the day in a very high-handed fashion to some degree up until fairly recently. In 1951, a fellow named B.C. Butler wrote a book called The Originality of St. Matthew, a critique of the two-document hypothesis, and was treated rather shabbily by scholars. They actually made political moves to keep his book from being circulated well, and they wouldn't involve him in discussions on the synoptic issues, in biblical society meetings, and they kind of castigated him and said he was stupid without answering his arguments. And that kind of gives you the flavor of the kind of intensity of commitment to the four gospel, or the four source theory, or the Markan hypothesis. Again, I think the intensity of commitment was largely because liberalism was still so strong. Liberalism had placed a lot of stock in Markan priority, and as a consequence, did not like to be like that grounding of their theories to be threatened. But in 1957, Nigel Turner wrote an article, "The Minor Verbal Agreements of Matthew and Luke Against Mark." He pointed out that although Mark does not go its own way against Matthew and Luke in any place, nevertheless, you do have places where Matthew and Luke do verbally agree against Mark. And this had already been noticed by Streeter. Streeter had called them minor agreements. And Turner argued that some of them are not so minor. There are too many of them to be purely accidental, Turner argued. In 1957, a guy named Hermann Riesenfeld wrote The Gospel Traditions and Its Beginnings, and he argued that a retention of Jesus' oral sayings by oral tradition was the source of the gospel material, although he didn't reject Markan priority as such. Birger Gerhardsen, however, in 1961, wrote a book called Memory and Manuscript, which was later developed in the beginnings of the gospel tradition. The memorization of gospel material by the disciples, he argued, reflects the practice of the rabbis. And he gave examples in rabbinic material of how the rabbis had memorized the sayings of previous rabbis, and also argued that Matthew, as a scribe, had been a note taker, and that was the source. Matthew's notes were the source of Jesus' sayings. to rapidly go through this story up into the modern period, William Farmer, in 1973, wrote The Synoptic Problem, where he tries to revitalize the Griesbach hypothesis. He has some excellent, really insightful and incisive criticisms of the two-source theory of the Markan hypothesis. However, his own reconstruction doesn't convince. But still, his work in challenging the Markan hypothesis is very interesting. In 1978, there was an interesting book that appeared, edited by W. O. Walker, which was entitled "The Relationship of the Gospels." This was not biblical scholars. This was a group of literary critics, mostly, and some Jewish scholars who got together and wanted to approach this problem from an unprejudiced viewpoint. And many of the articles in this volume, this was written by literary scholars who didn't have a preconceived interest in the Gospels themselves, they mostly argued that there seems to be a high degree of oral flexibility lying behind the Gospel variation, and that there does not seem to be that the ways in which Matthew and Mark and Luke are similar in terms of their wording do not seem to reflect the way in which other ancient writers used sources. So they actually had a much more openness to some kind of oral transmission. I'm not going to go through all of these people, but several people recently, since the 1980s, have increasingly begun to doubt the whether or not the market priority theory is really all that assured a result, and the paradigm of Luke simply using Matthew has been revived by M. D. Golder and D. McNichol. There's a book by John Wenham entitled "Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke." His primary interest is in dating of the Gospels, which he dates very early. He dates Matthew around 40, and Mark, which is using Matthew, as around the mid 40s. Actually, no, Mark is using a combination of oral and written sources, according to Wenham. And Luke was written in the mid-50s, according to Wenham. But he has a mixture of written and oral tradition there. But I think one of the most significant developments was in 1991. And this, you won't see this referred to much in the critical literature, but I think it's an important work. It's by Ken Bailey. Ken Bailey is best known for his studies on how biblical parables and stories reflect ancient Near Eastern culture. Bailey was a missionary amongst Bedouin and people in the Near East for many years, and so he saw a lot of similarities between the kind of cultural environment he was living in and things that were happening in the Gospels and in the Old Testament as well. But anyway, Ken Bailey wrote this article in 1991 in the Asia Journal of Theology entitled Informal Controlled Oral Tradition and Synoptic Gospels. And I think I'm discussing that in detail later, so I think I'm going to pass on that. But I'll just mention it here, and that Bailey, I think, gave a new footing for the view that there is a great deal of oral transmission going on lying behind the Gospels, which much better explains what's going on in the Gospels than any of the written source dependence theories. But we'll come to that later. Meanwhile, I still have to say that the two-source theory, that is Mark and Q as being the two most important sources for Matthew and Luke, that still is the by far and away the most dominant viewpoint, not only amongst critics, but also amongst evangelicals. Scholarly evangelicals recognized that the liberalism was placing an awful lot of stock in the two-source theory and in a theory of gospel's development. And one of the ways in which liberalism used this theory was, since Mark was the earliest gospel, that meant that all of the Christological stuff that you have in Matthew and Luke, which is there's a great deal more of it than you have in Mark, reflects later interest of the church, the dogmatic interest, and that this shows the pattern of development. That is, that originally you just remembered a great moral example in Jesus. That became a little bit built up in the Gospel of Mark itself, but not in the sayings source. The sayings source in Q reflects a very early tradition, and it has material which is basically Jesus preaching on how people are to behave. So liberalism felt that it had a great deal of stake in this, and I think, as I said early, conservatives who were perceptive saw that a lot of stake was being put in it, but they didn't themselves usually say that proves that the Markan hypothesis is wrong, and in fact, To a large degree, they really didn't address it. When they did, they had some kind of leanings towards Westcott's view of oral sources. But to a large degree, it wasn't even raised. The question wasn't. No, the typical fundamentalist wouldn't have even asked the question of sources of the Gospels. Most evangelicals simply said, well, they're similar because they're inspired and they remembered the inspired words of Jesus. And they really didn't get into the nitty-gritty and ask, well, what about the details? How come you have differences as well as similarities? Or why do you have certain similarities in some places but not in others? They didn't even raise those questions. So Machen, for example, who could have, didn't, partly because he was interested in other questions, and he got really thrown into theological questions. His original interest was in New Testament exegesis, but he got thrown into theological controversy, and so he didn't address it. By the time somebody who was really a scholarly evangelical did address it, that was Ned Stonehouse, and Stonehouse did accept the Markan priority, but he didn't want to build some kind of theological base on that, as though somehow Matthew and Luke were not historically reliable. But he did accept Markan priority and Matthew's use of Mark. So, anything else on that prehistory? We're going to look at the data, at the actual Gospels themselves to this. I'll just point out before I get on to that, this was in a recent catalog that came, and it shows you just, again, what's going on. You have one that's beyond the Q impasse, Luke's use of Matthew, which is a demonstration by the research team of the International Institute for Gospel Studies by Alan McNichol. And this book argues, there's actually composite of several different people, but this book argues that it's not that there was a Q. Mark was the first gospel, but Luke did not use Q, Luke used Matthew, and that Matthew is bringing in material from his own source, not Q. So here's an example of where things are still arguing, but on the same page, there is a book called The Lost Gospel Q, The Original Sayings of Jesus. And you see, this represents mainstream scholarship. And now it appears that without even arguing for your case, you can just assume the two-source theory, and you can build all kinds of stuff on the basis of that two-source theory. So, for example, a fellow wrote about 10 years ago, named Edwards, wrote a book called The Theology of Q. Not the theology of Matthew or Luke or Mark, the theology of Q, the theology of this reconstructed document. And here, the Lost Gospel Q, an effort to recover the original sayings of Jesus. You see, Mark, Matthew, and Luke don't give us the original Jesus. If you want to see what Jesus really taught, you go back to Q. And of course, as another scholar, I can't remember her name. She's a woman that teaches at Cambridge. It'll come to me in a later. But she wrote an article pointing out that, the title of the article was Q is What You Make It, and pointing out that all these different scholars have different ideas of what Q actually is. And Q can be whatever you want it to be. I mean, if you don't like a saying, oh, this doesn't sound like the historical Jesus, well, that wasn't part of Q, that was from somewhere else. So you can basically make Q whatever appeals to you. And here's an example of that, the Lost Gospel Q. If you don't like something that Jesus said in one of the Gospels, well, that wasn't part of Q. And if you do like it, well, it was part of Q. And so you can get back to a nice liberal Jesus. Yes.
Are there any evangelical scholars that defend a traditionalist view?
By traditionalist, what do you mean?
Matthew as priority, as the first.
Yes, some do. Wenham does. Wenham thinks that Matthew was the first gospel written in the 40s. Adolf Schlatter, writing around 1829, was the closest thing that Germany ever had to an evangelical. A scholarly evangelical. No, he was a good guy. I mean, Schlatter was a good guy. But Schlatter argued that Matthew was the first gospel written around early 50s. And a lot of evangelicals have still argued for the oral transmission theory, where all three of the gospels are dependent on early oral tradition. So yes, there are people that are still arguing that. I don't think that anybody any longer would argue simply the Augustinian view that Mark is simply abbreviating Matthew. Everybody pretty well recognizes that something is going on in addition to, even if Mark is using Matthew, there's something else going on besides that. So that's the present state of affairs, even amongst evangelicals. Okay, any other questions on historical development there? Okay, it's time for looking at pictures now. We have two reasons for looking at this. One is to learn why most critics have accepted Mark and priority, and to be able to evaluate conclusions based on it. And the second reason is to learn why some people think that Mark and priority is not so convincing. So let's look at, I mentioned earlier the phenomenon of order. Going to demonstrate that in a little more detail now. I pointed out earlier the Lachmann hypothesis that Matthew and Luke never agree against Mark with respect to order. Let me try to demonstrate some things here. The opening of the Gospels, you do have some material that is similar in Matthew and Luke, but not much. Mark does not have any early material, and as a consequence, Matthew and Luke, although they both have early material, they don't correspond very well. You do have, for example, an account of the birth of Jesus, but they're quite different. They don't resemble each other at all. And even the migration to Nazareth is quite different in the way they're told in the two Gospels. So there doesn't seem to be much literary dependence in those early chapters where Mark doesn't have anything. I already pointed out as well, once you get into things, things become very close with the story of John the Baptist. And then for most of the Gospels, you have some similarities, a roughly similar chronological development, but with quite a few differences. So, for example, here you have after the call of Matthew, which you have the, I'm sorry, right? Yeah, right before the call of Matthew and after it. You have the account of the leper, which occurs in the same place in all three Gospels. Little bits of variation there. Then you have a couple more miracle stories and a call of Levi Matthew. And that's in the same place. Then you have, healing of Jairus' daughter, which occurs here in Matthew, but a little farther down in Mark and Luke. Very, very similar chronological development, but with some differences. Okay, and once again, you can see where it's always the case that Matthew will agree with either Mark. Mark will either agree with Matthew or else with Luke. You don't have Matthew and Luke has something that Mark has in a different place. You'll never have it that you'll have a thing, you'll have a text here and a text here, but that you'll have an arrow in Mark. It just doesn't occur. There's a peculiarity of Luke. That Luke tends to gather a whole bunch of material into what is called the Perean ministry. This is chapters 9 to 18 or so in Luke, which is the narrative of Jesus traveling from Jerusalem after the Transfiguration. He goes across the Jordan. He comes down Perea on the eastern side of the Jordan until just above the Dead Sea. Then he crosses the Jordan again up to Jericho, and then makes the ascent from Jericho up to Jerusalem. Well, that Perean ministry in the territory called Perea, which is the Transjordan, all of this material, some of which occurs in Mark and Matthew, some of which occurs in only in Matthew, and some of which is peculiar to Luke, all of this is piled together in this lengthy segment in Luke. That is a peculiarity. Why did Luke do that? Or is it rather the case that Matthew or Mark were changing the order of things there, and that Luke is preserving the original? And once you get then to the end of Jesus' ministry, so for example with the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus, once again this basic chronological structure becomes a very tight chronological structure, where you have almost everything is in exactly the same order in all three Gospels when you get down to the crucifixion. So you'll note that the Passion Week, which really is the center point of all three Gospels, becomes very close in order, and to a large degree close in wording as well, although, again, by no means anywhere close to precise wording. So that gives you the overall data with regard to the order. There are no cases in the triple tradition where Matthew, Mark, and Luke all differ in order. So you would think that if Matthew and Luke were using Mark freely, that might occasionally happen, and so that that is a little bit of a problem. By the way, the departure does occur with wording. You can have cases where all three Gospels have entirely different wording. So it appears that Mark, at least in some way, from the phenomenon of order, appears to be medial between Matthew and Luke. There's the Lachman observation again. Now, if it is the case, and that's a big if it is the case that there is literary dependence, what that means, the fact that Mark occupies this medial position, means that either Mark used Matthew and Luke, or that Matthew and Luke used Mark. It's the only literary dependence theory that makes sense given this observation. So that Lachman observation really boiled it down to you've got to pick either Griesbach or Holtzmann, two source, mark and priority. Those are the options if you hold to a strict literary dependence theory. Okay, now with regard to wording, it's a little bit more complicated. You'll note here, I showed this earlier, but then Jesus said to his disciples, "If someone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and let him take up his cross and let him follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake," and going on here, "and the Gospels, will save it." Well, again, you can see that Matthew and Mark, so far as this saying of Jesus goes, is identical, and Luke has something virtually identical except for the very small change to the present infinitive, erkesthai. Sometimes that happens, particularly with regard to the words of Jesus, and that is a significant matter now. The words of Jesus are much more frequently exactly the same in all three Gospels. Narrative is sometimes the same, but more frequently divergent. Now, Where Matthew and Mark differ such as here. I can't fit all this on here, but where Matthew and Mark differ, Matthew usually reads a bit more smoothly. What I've done here is I've underlined in green where there's exact verbal correspondence, and in red where there is similar correspondence, but the words are a little different in some ways. For example, here, in the desert has been is in a different place, and it's expressed a little differently than it is in Mark here in the desert, with ep with the genitive as opposed to n with the dative. And here, and he said to them, using the dative, here it's he asked them, the accuser, which of course obviously is expected. Here there's a little bit of a word order difference. Do you have bread? And it just means the same thing, but the word order is reversed. So red is similar, green is identical, and then the stuff that's not underlined is different in the Gospels. And you'll notice that to some degree, Matthew's wording and the way he phrases things is a little bit more elegant. Just for example here, he uses the participial construction here, and having announced to the crowd to lie down on the ground, or commanded them, this simply uses parataxis, and he commanded them to lie down on the ground, and taking the bread, he broke it. So Matthew tends to make things a little bit more, or tends to read a little bit more smoothly than Mark does. And that's also an interesting observation, because that gives ammunition to those who want to say that Matthew used Mark, because you can see that if Matthew is smoother than Mark, you can understand why a scribe would make something a little smoother. It's difficult to understand why he would make it rougher. That's significant that many people have pointed out. Thirdly, several sayings of Jesus are found in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. Now, I mentioned earlier, this Q is thought of as a saying source, as having material that was found in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. Most of the material that is in Matthew and Luke, but is not in Mark, is of the nature of a saying of Jesus. And here's an example. That's the wrong example there. I need 109 here. Here we go. Here's an example of what's found in Matthew and Luke. You'll notice that the wording is very, very similar, almost exact. But this is a saying of Jesus. This is where Jesus prays to the Father and says, I thank you, Father, I confess to you, Father, Lord of heaven and of earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and the understanding, and you have revealed them to the babies. Yes, indeed, Father, because thus it was your good pleasure before you. And all things have been given to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and neither does he know the Father. Does anyone know the Father except the Son, and to whomever the Son wishes to reveal him? Almost identical in Luke. So sayings of Jesus can be very close together very close in word order. But Matthew 11 is in an entirely different place. This is considerably prior to the confession of Peter and the transfiguration. Luke, however, it's after the transfiguration, which also is after the confession of Peter. So in very different places in the chronology in Matthew and Luke. and yet word for word identical. A fourth observation is that sometimes Matthew and Luke agree in wording against Mark. I'll give you the example, I'll give you the text. It's Matthew 21, 1 to 2, Mark 11, 1 to 2, and Luke 19, 29 to 30, which is a parallel. And there's an example where Matthew and Luke agree in wording against Mark. However, most of these tend to be, as I said, minor, and sometimes, most of the time, are explainable by reference to style. That is, that Mark has expressed something awkwardly, and both Matthew and Luke thought of the same way to improve it. It could be explained that way, although there's a few places where that is a little bit stretching credibility, but at least it's possible, and has convinced most people. A fifth observation is that Mark seems to occupy the medial position not just in wording, but also in order. Here we go. Now this is a curious example here. Here I've underlined in green material that is the same in Matthew and Mark, and in red the material that is common in Mark and in Luke. And you'll notice that Mark appears to be almost combining Matthew and Luke. And by the way, this is a passage that Farmer, in defending the Griesbach hypothesis that Mark used Matthew and Luke, refers to. Let me just show you here. Matthew has, when it became evening, they brought to him many people who were demon-possessed. Well, Luke, at this place, has, when the sun went down, as many as were having weakness or diseases, all those who had various diseases, who were ill with various diseases, they brought them to him, these people that were afflicted with various illnesses. Okay, what has Mark done? Well, Mark has, when it became evening, when the sun went down, they brought to him all those who were sick and those who were demon-possessed. All right, now it looks like, on the surface of it, Mark has taken material from Matthew and combined it with material from Luke, and that's why you have doublets like, when it became evening, when the sun went down. I mean, why would you do it that? Why would you say the same thing using those two different ways of saying it? On the other hand, if that is not the case, if Matthew and Luke are using Mark, it is stretching credibility to suggest that Matthew picked out exactly the words out of Mark that Luke did not use, and that Luke picked out those words which Matthew did not use. It's almost as though Luke had a copy of Matthew and was making sure that he didn't copy anything that Matthew did. It picked out the exact opposite words. So it's very curious here. It goes on here. This isn't just this one verse, but as you can see here, he's combined this other material as well. Matthew has material on casting out of demons. Luke has it on healing diseases. Mark seems to combine the two. So that is a quite a problem for the Mark and priority, and as a curiosity. All right. Okay. One more thing to show you here, and that is that Luke's differences from Mark tend to be more in the direction of clarity for a Gentile reader. Very frequently, Luke, when it does revise Mark, will revise it in such a way. Okay, I can give you an example. Out of Mark 13, which is the Olivet Discourse, Luke, instead of having the abomination of desolation, which was a very mysterious sounding phrase, Luke simply says, when you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem, which is very comprehensible to a Gentile or anybody else. So Luke tends to simplify things for a Gentile reader. Well, I just wanted to mention before we finish up the class that statistically, 90% of the material that is in Mark is also in Matthew. 58% of the material that is in Mark is also in Luke. Only about 2% of Mark is not found in either Matthew or Luke. So in other words, 98% of Mark you have from Matthew and Luke. There's only 2% of Mark which is distinctive to Mark. The church, for most of its history, did somewhat disregard Mark. It wasn't until the liberalism really in the 19th century put this new weight on Mark, that Mark was the most reliable because it was the earliest gospel, that Mark came really to be appreciated. Well, I think that even apart from that 2% is a little bit of a misleading statement, because when we say that only 2% of what's in Mark is not found in Matthew and Luke, that means 2% of the story material is not found. However, there's a great deal of information and perspective in Mark that is not found or is different than Matthew and Luke. And so it still stands as a very informative gospel in its own right, even if it is not the first gospel. So a new appreciation in the last 50 years or so for the Gospel of Mark has focused not on the fact that it's the earliest gospel, but rather that it has a unique perspective on the ministry of Jesus. Now, I mentioned earlier that there were certain relationships that were possible if there is direct literary dependency. In other words, one gospel is using or copying from another gospel. And I mentioned that there's really only two basic possibilities. Either Mark is first and was used by Matthew and Luke, or else Matthew and Luke were used by Mark. Those are the only two options if there is direct literary dependence. However, the particular permutations of that general statement are more than two. I've listed on your outline three of the basic possibilities that are generally entertained today. Now, I said three plausible solutions. There's variations on these, as I said. And just to give you an example of that, the second one there, B, is the basic two-source theory as propounded by Holtzmann. Actually, Holtzmann had an Ur-Marcus, not Mark there, but and furthermore, the four-document theory of Streeter is more complex than that because it has a special Matthew source. And actually, well, let me put it up here. First of all, ignore this one for the moment. Well, I'll just mention this. This oral theory was the theory that fairly well held sway amongst evangelicals until this century, which was simply that the memory of what the disciples were teaching and what Jesus himself had taught, the oral memory, resulted in each of the Gospels individually without dependence. And I pointed out the difficulty with that is the very, very high degree of correspondence in Greek. Not just in subject matter, but in Greek, even though the teaching was likely to have taken place in Aramaic. And so not many would hold simply to a pure oral theory anymore. Actually, there is one person. There is a German scholar named Eta Lindemann, who used to be an out-and-out Bultmannian. She was converted about 15 years or so ago, and threw out everything that she had learned in university, and including all her source theories and things, and has written a couple of books arguing that all of the Gospels are entirely independent from one another. There's no oral prehistory. It's simply the memory of the disciples that is accurate enough that you have a very close correspondence. She has not persuaded many people. But here, the two-document theory, in its simplified form, is graphically illustrated. This is the same as on your chart there. Streeter's theory is a variation on the two-document theory. It's a little hard to see it in this particular outline here. But let me put this under here. But the four-document theory, again, you can see that basically it's still Mark and Q, and Matthew and Luke are both dependent on Mark and Q. But there's a complication in that Streeter proposed an earlier form of Luke, which was actually comprised of, a special Lucan source and this document Q. And then this proto-Luke was later collated with the Gospel of Mark to form our final Gospel of Luke. Essentially, this is still a variation of the same theory. I mentioned also yesterday the theory of Golder, which simply bypasses Q altogether and simply says that Matthew and Luke used Mark and that the common material of Matthew and Luke came about because Luke was using Matthew. There are a few people that hold to this view, and it does have the advantage that you don't have to hypothesize some strange document, but not many have held to this view simply because there's too many points at which if Luke is using Matthew, then he's making changes in it which are almost incomprehensible as to why he would make those changes. And then the other don't worry about this Chapman thing. Nobody holds it except Chapman, and it's not terribly helpful. But the two gospel theory, which, as I said, ruled the day amongst critics up until the latter part of the 19th century, is that Matthew was the first gospel, Luke used Matthew, and then Mark combined the two. That suffers from the same problem as the Golder theory, because the Matthew to Luke transferal is just not easy always to explain. I'll just mention it. Boismard, a French scholar, has proposed a multiple source theory, a very complex one, as you can see. And the difficulty with this is that it's virtually impossible to disprove or prove because you've got so many hypothetical stages that anything that's a problem, you could simply hypothesize some other stage. So again, these very, very complex theories don't persuade anybody except the person that develops them. So they can bypass that one. This last one here, oral theory with measure of successive dependence, is interesting from the standpoint of John Wenham has suggested that there is something to be said for this oral tradition relating to all three Gospels, but that doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain the very close correspondence, both in wording and in order. And so he's hypothesized that whereas all three Gospels do have direct connection with the oral tradition, the oral teaching, nevertheless, they are using each other. And in particular, Mark is using Matthew, and then Luke is using both Mark and Matthew. So it comes out being something like a combination of the Augustinian view, which is that Mark used Matthew and Luke used both, and Westcott's view, which was that all three Gospels independently got their material from oral tradition. That's interesting, but again, he's formulated his theory in such a way that if it's false, you still can't disprove it, because anything any data that may go contrary to his theory, he can easily work around by virtue of, if it doesn't fit one pattern, then he can fit it into the other. So again, Wenham has not persuaded very many people, but it is an interesting attempt to resolve the question. Okay, that's a little bit of an expansion of those three basic solutions that you have on your chart here. And again, I'm not going to expect you to remember all these outlines and diagrams of the various viewpoints. That's not my interest. My interest is simply that you know the basic outlines of the way the problem has been approached, and the fact that all of them have difficulties, and this is where we're going to go now. I'll just point out that, I'm going to skip some of that. I'll just point out that all of the various viewpoints have difficulties in that there is no explanation of literary dependence where there are not some passages which seem to suggest the opposite. Most people hold to the two-source theory, or the four-source, or some variation on that approach, Mark and Q being the original documents. Most people hold to that view simply because that view has fewer problems than the other views. But anybody who honestly looks at this material for very long comes to the conclusion that the only way you can hold any of these theories is by overlooking or is by explaining away certain passages. And so there isn't really any solution which solves all the problems. Just let me give you, the two dominant views, which is the two-source theory by far and away the most dominant view, and the Griesbach view, which is the second most common amongst critics. I'll specifically mention some difficulties with them. And the reason here is that you may encounter somebody sometime that's giving you the standard line, and you may want to point out a few little difficulties with that. One, I already pointed out yesterday, and that is that with regard to the two-source theory, or Markan priority, is the fact that here in Mark 1, 32 to 34, this appears to be a combining of Matthew and Luke. And to tell you the truth, I really don't see any way to explain this passage if Matthew and Luke are using Mark. Because if Matthew and Luke are using Mark, it does mean that Matthew is picking out of this passage exactly what Luke didn't, and vice versa. And that just seems to stretch credibility a little bit. And it's much easier to explain it as Mark combining these two traditions. And that has led some people, such as William Farmer, to argue that Mark is the later gospel and combining Matthew and Mark. This is not the only passage where that sort of thing occurs. Again, here, this is the where Jesus talks about the Passover is coming up and the fact that he's going to be crucified. And Matthew has quite a lengthy account. Luke has a very abbreviated kind of account here. But you can see, again, as Matthew goes on, the words, after 2 days is the Passover. This is, by the way, this is the same place. This is the parallel passage. It's not different places that just happen to correspond verbally. It's the same place in the account. And both Matthew and Mark record that it's a Passover after 2 days. Mark adds the material that it's also the unleavened bread feast. And whereas Luke has it's the feast of the unleavened bread and does say that it's the Passover. So the Passover is in all three Gospels here. But of course, that's the obvious word to use for what's coming. And so that doesn't, that's fits all right. And then here a little bit later is both Mark and Luke have the fact that the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how they might kill him. And Mark and Matthew both have that Matthew has, and they were taking counsel together in order that they might seize and kill him by guile. And Mark also has by guile that they might seize him and kill him, they might kill him. And also Mark has the information about they were saying, but not upon the feast, lest there be a rebellion amongst the people. And likewise, Matthew has not upon the feast and mentions the revolt or the rebellion. So I'll move that over there. So Matthew and Mark have much material in common, and Luke and Mark have material in common. But it's, again, if Matthew and Luke are using Mark, it's as though they sort of agreed on ahead of time, okay, you take that word and I'll take this word. And it just doesn't seem to be easy to explain. Now, unfortunately, I didn't bring it today, but I had intended to bring a copy for all of you of the Feeding of the 5,000. The reason I can't put it up on the screen is it's too long, and it occurs in all four Gospels, so it just doesn't fit on the screen very well. But take a look at it in the in the Synopsis Quatuor Evangeliorum, by the way. If you're going to do study on the Gospels, and I'm saying even for such things as Sunday school or sermon preparation, this is virtually indispensable. What it does is, well, all of these overheads that I've been putting up here are excerpts, are Xeroxes out of the Synopsis. The Synopsis takes you all the way through the material content of all four Gospels and retains the order of all four Gospels by adding in the parallel material in the other Gospels in smaller type, where you have the main account of that particular Gospel in larger print. Now, what that means is that every passage which is in the same place and parallel, you can easily compare what is in Matthew and what is in Mark and what is in Luke. You don't have to try to flip back and forth between Matthew and Luke and or Mark and Luke and figure out what's going on, which is a very complicated task. It lays it all out for you. Furthermore, this one, mine is all in Greek, but you can get one, you can get this that's Greek on one side and English on the other. So if you find yourself struggling some with the Greek, you can still make reference to the Greek and also have the English there as well. So it's a very handy source. That's called Synopsis of the Four Gospels. But it looks very much like this, and except that the title is in English instead of Latin. Don't ask me why Latin. I should have put it in Greek. I don't know why they didn't. But anyway, you can get the English version, as I said, as the English and Greek, as well as just the plain Greek. And you've got the apparatus all right there. It's not a real extensive apparatus, but you can see major textual variations within each of the Gospels. And for doing an exegesis paper, it's real handy, because when you do your exegesis paper, you will want to check the other Gospels and see what they have in that passage, or if they have a parallel passage. And if they do have a parallel passage, what's distinctive about your particular Gospel as compared to the other Gospels.